Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage takes the frustrations out of getting a mortgage by letting you safely share your financial information with the touch of a button. Get approved online in minutes at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the news this week, darker and uglier on the campaign trail. In Reno, Hillary Clinton accuses Donald Trump of promoting racist lies.
Donald Trump has built his campaign on prejudice and paranoia. He is taking hate groups mainstream and helping a radical fringe take over the Republican Party.
In Manchester, New Hampshire, Trump says Clinton is talking about race because she can't defend her own record.
She lies, and she smears, and she paints decent Americans, you, as racists.
And in Italy, a deadly earthquake. Guy Thomas of the Italian Red Cross describes the devastation.
It's terrible because it's like a bomb fell down and there's nothing there anymore.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, Hayes Brown of BuzzFeed News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. What do you make of the tone, the accusations on the campaign trail this week? What about Trump's shift on immigration? New questions about the Clinton Foundation? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington is Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Karen, welcome back to On Point, and thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Bob, and Hayes, and Jack.
From New York, Hayes Brown is with us, world news editor for BuzzFeed News. Hayes, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me on today, Bob.
From Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hi, Jack.
Hello, Bob, Hayes, and Karen.
All right. Is this a new low in the presidential campaign as both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton bring accusations of racism and bigotry to the campaign? Karen, let's start with you.
I think what they are both doing is bringing to the surface something that has been a subtext here all along, which is, you know, the degree to which Trump's support is fueled in part by, you know, kind of white nationalist sentiments, that there are a lot of these groups that are drawn to his candidacy. Now, Hillary Clinton, it was interesting, did not go so far as to call Trump himself a racist in her speech. He did call her a bigot, but he is accusing her of, you know, also impugning a lot, you know, millions of others of his supporters as she makes these charges.
Hayes Brown.
I think that one of the things that people hate the most is to be called racist. No matter what their views actually are, they just can't stand the idea that whatever ingrained feelings they have could be construed as racist. And I think that Clinton in her speech did a great job of pulling to the surface all these and threading together all these things that have occurred over the very, very long presidential campaign that we've had so far, with Trump appealing through, whether through dog whistles or overtly, to this white nationalist crowd. And while it's true that all of Trump's supporters don't feel this way, the fact that many of them, in fact, do and continue to stick with Trump throughout his various shifts, I think it was very appropriate for Clinton to finally call that out.
Jack Beatty, Hillary Clinton has said that Donald Trump is taking a hate movement mainstream and is peddling bigotry. What's her big picture strategy here?
Well, she laid out the evidence for that. I thought the speech was remarkable for its dispassionate summoning of things Trump and his supporters have said. She wasn't making charges. She was citing what they had said. And Steve Bannon, the executive of editor publisher of Breitbart News, is the connection between the alt-right, this group that she described as a white nationalist congeries of bloggers and so on. His Breitbart News is a vector for that movement. It's been called that by the Southern Poverty Law Center. They don't make any bones about that, apparently. And he is Trump's campaign manager, or the executive of his campaign. So Trump, you know, exactly what Hillary described happened. She said he is mainstreaming this alt-right perspective by putting it into his campaign. And that's a description of what he's done.
Is Clinton converting new voters, or is she trying to cement the image of Donald Trump as unacceptable as a leader of the free world, Jack?
Well, I think she's trying to go behind him to the suburban Republican voter and say, look, you don't want to be ashamed of yourself on Election Day. Vote for, and that's the way she's putting it, vote for, you know, you can't vote for this man. And basically saying, you know, I either stay home or vote for me. So I think it is a strategic sort of shot behind him, as, of course, his appeal to African-American voters is to her base.
Well, here is Donald Trump hurling the bigot label right back at Hillary Clinton at a rally in Jackson, Mississippi. On Wednesday, Trump attacked Clinton as he tried to appeal to African-American and Hispanic voters.
Hillary Clinton is a bigot who sees people of color only as votes, not as human beings worthy of a better future. She's going to do nothing for African Americans. She's going to do nothing for the Hispanics.
Karen, what is Donald Trump getting out of this? What's he gained from using this language?
I think that this is not a play for African Americans and Hispanic voters. It's more sort of speaking to his white supporters, perhaps his more moderate supporters, to sort of himself slip the label of bigot. There's sort of an I'm rubber and you're glue quality to this.
Well, Trump does seem to realize that during the course of the summer, he really did hurt himself with black and Latino voters, openly courting them now. He used a line that's gotten a lot of play this week. What do you have to lose? He said. Does anybody view this as any kind of effective argument to win votes? Jack, what's your take?
Well, I guess I agree with Karen. It's not going to win votes from African Americans. The dystopian picture he gave of African-American life was deeply offensive and full of falsehoods about the unemployment rate, the crime rate, and so on. So, no. But will it, on the other hand, gain him supporters in those Republican suburbs? I think that's the calculation, that somehow it'll make people, to get back to that model, you don't have to be ashamed of yourself. I'm not a bigot. She's the bigot. And I talk about the problems of African Americans. So I think it is much more aimed at that Republican suburban vote.
We have a caller on this topic. Carl is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Carl, thanks, and welcome to On Point. Go ahead.
Hey, I totally agree, because you can't hire the leader of Breitbart one week to lead your campaign, and then the next week try and outreach to black people. It's laughable. And even more, it's insulting our political minds, because he's assuming that black people don't understand who he's really talking to. He's not talking to us. He's not really trying to get our vote. He's trying to get the vote of a suburban white woman in Philadelphia, or the suburban white woman of Detroit, to try and get that vote to say, see, I'm not as racist as they say I am. I'm talking to black people. And when you assume, you make an ass of yourself. And this is what he's done. He's done this to our political discourse. He has got guys like Blackboard. And I can't accept what you all said earlier, that these are dog whistles. You can't, this is not a dog whistle when you hire the guy who is the leader of this white nationalist movement and give them, at the very least, a platform and the voice to speak. You can't call that a dog whistle. That's right. That's out and out racist on the Donald Trump campaign. And no matter how soft he talks, it's still racism. Just look at his words. You know, Hillary Clinton, whoever's making her commercials, he or she need to give back half her paycheck, because it is so simple to cut commercials against Donald Trump and his bigotry that he's used over the past year. Just use his own words, and that's pretty much what they've been doing.
Carl, I take it there's no way Donald Trump can convert you to his side come Election Day in November. What about your friends? Is there any
way in high holy hell could he convince me to vote for him? He is the ugliest form of our country. He's selfish. He's never done anything for anyone but himself. His policies are incoherent at best. He's a greedy person. He has no humanity. He has no feelings for anyone outside of himself. And you can't blame him, because this is the way he was born. If people would just look up his father, this is what he is. He is what he is. He's a sociopath. And I don't say these words lightly. I'm not joking, not playing, not being hyperbolic. He's a sociopath, and he is what he is, and we can't allow him near the White House. And if the Republican Party don't wake up fast, this man is going to destroy them for two or three generations with all people, not just white, not just black or brown people in this country, but for people that's coming up that's 18 to 30 years old, and they're paying attention to this thing for the first time. They're going to think that this is what the Republican Party is. They are cementing what they are.
Okay, Carl, thank you very much. We appreciate your calling On Point. Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Karen Tumulty, why about a minute left before we break? Why has it been so hard and awkward for Trump to rebrand himself?
Well, because he's been running for over a year, and he's also kind of veered all over the place. But don't forget, as recently as the Republican convention, you had a series of speakers mocking the Black Lives movement. You know, he's spoken of Hispanics as illegal immigrants, as racists and murderers. I mean, it's hard to make sure, you know, try to make people forget all that.
This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about another big week in the news. You can join the conversation. What stories are you watching and talking about this week? The earthquake in Italy, the attacks in Turkey, the charged rhetoric on the campaign trail. We're talking with Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, Hayes Brown of BuzzFeed News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Let's pivot for a moment, talk about Hillary Clinton on the campaign trail and the Clinton Foundation. She continues to get hammered over her use of State Department emails and her use of the private email account, and the questions over whether the Clinton Foundation was used as a sort of bank for deposits for people trying to buy State Department access, as critics like to call it. Here she was in an interview with CNN's Anderson Cooper on Wednesday, responding to Donald Trump's claim that she sold favors and access in exchange for cash from people who donated to the foundation when she was Secretary of State.
My work as Secretary of State was not influenced by any outside forces. I made policy decisions based on what I thought was right to keep Americans safe and to protect U.S. interests abroad. No wild political attack by Donald Trump is going to change that.
Hayes Brown, her strategy seems to be, if I keep repeating this, that I did nothing wrong, that I regret what I did in terms of the emails, that voters will forget about it. But there's very little chance of that, don't you think?
I really do, especially with the Republicans just hammering away at it. And the Clinton campaign hasn't really done itself very many favors with this story, in how they've almost refused at times to really talk about this in such a deep, in a really deep, substantive way that lets them just put it behind them. And as far as the Clinton Foundation itself goes, I mean, it does great work. It's provided help to so many people in developing countries around the world. But it's a matter of optics in this case. There was an Associated Press story earlier this week with the bombshell that of the people that met with Clinton, private citizens who met with Clinton, not in government, during her time as Secretary of State, many of them had donated to the Clinton Foundation. The problem is a lot of these were big-name people who you would expect to meet with the Secretary of State anyway, like one of the founders of the microloan movement in India. So they have a lot of problems with optics and not substance, which is somewhere that the Clintons have always found a way to seem to fall flat on their face when trying to present, no, this is actually the truth to the public.
Yeah, they don't come to this as a blank slate either. Those of us who were covering Washington in 1996 will recall that, for instance, if you gave – they had a program going where if you wrote a big check to the party – this was back in the soft money days – you could have a sleepover in the Lincoln bedroom, or you could attend a session in the map room of the White House where regulators who regulated your industry would be present. So this isn't like it comes into an environment where, again, there hasn't been a pattern like this in the past. And also now they've announced that, you know, if she is elected, that they would no longer take money from foreign and corporate donors. Well, if that is the case, why don't they stop doing it right now? Why did they do it while she was Secretary of State? If there is an impropriety here, if there is even an appearance of impropriety, it existed then, now, and it exists now.
Jack Beatty on this.
Yes, you know, Hillary was asked about this on Morning Joe this morning, and she just filibustered, really. Now, there was a possible answer. She could have said, yes, I did meet with these people. We did. The government did no favors for them, but they did favors for humanity. They gave 100 – the people who met with her, this 84 out of – 85 out of 154 private citizens were donors. They contributed $156 million. She could have said, here's what we did with that money. Now, maybe I shouldn't have done that. But I thought giving them, you know, a little of my time was the least we could do to fight AIDS and all the rest. The point is, that's a human explanation for a seeming conflict of interest. She's too self-righteous to do that. It was, oh, no, we didn't do anything. It is so implausible. For her, the standard is always, are we going to jail? Is this illegal? Her counsel, David Kendall, that's what he tells her day and night. It is not illegal, Hillary. They won't send you to jail. Then they're going to do it. They go right up to every ethical line and slide over it. And by the way, I think this, she said, no outside force influenced my decision. David Serrata for the Business Weekly Investor Daily, I think it's called, he had a series of pieces about arms sales to the Middle East, to Saudi Arabia, to some of these other Gulf states, and the connection, the propinquity in time between the approval of these arms sales by the State Department and the contributions to the Clinton Foundation from these governments or rich people there. Just the timing screamed outside influence. And what did these arms sales accomplish? Right now, of course, the Saudis are murdering innocent people in Yemen in our name with our weapons. They bombed a Doctors Without Borders hospital. They seem to do that regularly just the other day. And, you know, is that part of the price of swelling the coffers of the Clinton? We don't know, but the whole thing just stinks.
I want you, Karen, I want you to look ahead for me, if you would. A new poll shows just 11% of people think that Hillary Clinton is trustworthy. This has got to be hurting her. Is this going to dog her all the way to Election Day? And how does she effectively fight this off? Or is that even possible at this point?
I don't think it's possible at this point. I think, you know, the country has known her now for a quarter of a century. People have pretty much made up their minds about her. It was interesting last night, the Annenberg conducted a focus group of undecided voters in Wisconsin. It was a Democratic pollster, Peter Hart, who conducted the focus group. And these undecided voters said that the choice they feel like they have this fall is between a liar and a drunk uncle. So it's basically the textbook play in a campaign like this, where both of the candidates have historically high negatives, is you just do what you can to make the race about the other person.
Jack, on this?
Yes, I mean, it's you're worse than me. I mean, that's where we are. I mean, the negatives are so unprecedented. But, you know, with Donald Trump now, we see something really – he's sensing defeat. I mean, the Trump campaign is flailing because Trump's candidacy is failing. I mean, he's – in a recent poll, he's down 10. And when you look at it, well over half, 59% of people in that poll say that he does appeal to bigotry, including a plurality of Republicans. So – he is really he keeps changing his positions now on immigration. It's Etch-a-Sketch on steroids because he can't find any traction with the electorate. I mean, it's just not happening for him.
All right, let's talk about Donald Trump on the issue of immigration, which was in the news again this week, and I'm sure will be in the weeks to come, as he apparently attempts to rewrite his plan to be tough on undocumented immigrants. He says he might soften the plan to deport 11 million immigrants in the country illegally. Here he was on Tuesday speaking with Fox News' Sean Hannity about this subject. Hannity asked Trump if he might change any part of the law to accommodate people who have, quote, contributed to society, are law-abiding, and have kids here. And here was Trump's response.
There certainly can be a softening because we're not looking to hurt people. We want people. We have some great people in this country. We have some great, great people in this country. So, but we're going to follow the laws of this country.
Hayes, Donald Trump almost instantly succeeded in drawing criticism of some of his staunchest backers who supported him specifically because of the get tough approach on folks in the country illegally. Clearly, he's self-inflicted yet another wound here. How does the damage what's the damage with his supporters, do you think?
Well, I it's really fascinating to watch this play out because the way that he's been facilitating between these positions that he just changes his mind on hour by hour, it seems like his supporters are trying so hard to stay with him. They want to believe. They want so hard to believe that he's just saying things for the public. He's making nice so that he can get elected and then he'll shift. But he's not doing himself any favors by the way he keeps changing what he said. In that clip, we heard him say that a softening is possible. But then just a day later, he said, people are saying it's a softening. I think of it more as a hardening. And people don't know what to do with that anymore. One of his spokespeople said that he hasn't changed his policy. He's just changing the words he's saying, which is amazing. It's amazing that we're at this point in this campaign, that that's a legitimate thing that someone who is running a helping run a presidential campaign can say live on the air. And we don't know where Donald Trump actually sits at this point, what his thinking really is. He's contradicting his campaign manager in public over these policies. So it's a guess.
I believe we have a Donald Trump supporter on the line. Let's get his take. Don is calling from Elizabethtown, Kentucky. Hi, Don. You're on Point.
Hello, everyone. Hey, I just wanted to pretty much voice my disgust at this whole thing.
What whole thing?
Beginning the whole racist Donald Trump. You guys started off the show that way, and instead of concentrating on the more important matters of Hillary Clinton's issues, the DNC improprieties, voting issues, Benghazi, or just whatever in general, you just want to concentrate on what Donald Trump, what you guys think Donald Trump says. Even over 12 months ago, you couldn't put Donald Trump or racist in the same statement. But yet now, since he said some stuff about illegal immigration or Syrian refugees being unvetted, even though that was vetted by the Obama administration, you guys just want to concentrate and just say that he is a racist, and you guys have been playing this for the last 12 months. So no wonder why his voter appeal has been dropping, because that's all they've been hammered with by the headlines of Donald Trump racist is. Donald Trump race is at when you've just completely taken everything out of context.
Okay. Well, not completely out of context, I would argue, because as the candidates hurl these comments back and forth at each other, you know, we're obligated to cover them as they say them. I want to ask you a question about the immigration plan. Are you with Donald Trump on his original immigration plan to deport 11 million immigrants in the country illegally? And what's your thinking today as Mr. Trump considers rewriting that plan?
Well, when he did actually initially stated it, he also stated that anybody that was on the quote-unquote good side of it could come back in legally through the legal channels and keep all the people that were committing crimes and whatnot out of the country. But yeah, that's the rule of law. You know, you're going to come into this country, you should come in legally. If you're going to come in as a refugee, then you need to come in through a vetted process. And if that process is broke, then it needs to be fixed. The Obama administration has said it was broke, and if it's not fixed, then, you know, how are we going to let all these people in?
So if he backs away from his originally stated plan, you're still with him?
Yes, sir.
All right, Don, thank you very much for calling On Point from Elizabethtown, Kentucky. We appreciate it. Karen, let me ask you, what do you think is driving Trump? For example, does he realize that the get tough approach might be damaging him in battleground Florida because of the Cuban community there? What's at play here in rewriting the immigration plan, and what's at stake for him?
I think that asking what is driving Donald Trump is sort of a hard question, and in many ways a pointless question. He is often driven by whatever his impulse of the moment is. For instance, on this question of whether 11 million people ought to be deported, he turned around and took a poll of the audience. He often will just sort of go with his gut, play off his sense of what the passions in the audience are. And as a result, it really has been hard both for his various teams of campaign management handlers to sort of keep him on message for more than a day or two.
Jack Beatty, care to predict what Donald Trump's new immigration plan, if he actually comes up with one, might look like?
That is a bootless endeavor. I mean, it can change. The word mercurial, I mean, in the dictionary, you should have a picture of him. The fact is, he has no palpable convictions. You know, people criticize politicians by saying, oh, you're a liberal, you're a conservative, why can't you be flexible? But, you know, at least those philosophies anchor someone in some pattern of consistency. A liberal will see things a certain way, a conservative a different way. And those are guides for sort of holding them accountable. With Trump, it's all negotiable. And so when people say he's not a conservative, they are absolutely right. He's Trump. That's who he is.
All right. I want to bring a comment that Hillary Clinton made this week into the discussion, if I might. She charges that a radical fringe is taking over the GOP under Donald Trump. Here she is in Reno, Nevada last night in a speech where she linked Trump to the alt-right movement.
Now, of course, there's always been a paranoid fringe in our politics, a lot of it arising from racial resentment, but it's never had the nominee of a major party stoking it, encouraging it, and giving it a national megaphone until now.
Hayes Brown, do you think she's right? Is the radical fringe taking over the GOP?
I think that what was really interesting about her speech is how much she tried to decouple the idea of this alt-right movement with the mainstream GOP as the most of the people in the GOP see themselves. They definitely are growing in number. They turned out in huge numbers to vote for Donald Trump this year, and they see a lot of themselves in him, but in trying to make the case that they don't represent the entirety of the GOP yet, no matter who their nominee is, Clinton was foregoing, it feels like, almost an opportunity to make the heavy play for Democrats down ticket to give them a boost in order to say, members of the Republican Party, I know this isn't you. You are better than this. You know you're better than this. Please think about what you're doing. And I really think that it it worked out really well, or hopefully will.
Jack Beatty, about a minute left before we take a break. Your take on this?
Yes, I think that, you know, she certainly is right about the facts. And will this help her politically? I don't know. I mean, it certainly the timing of it helped her. I mean, with all the focus on the Clinton Foundation, she comes out with this big speech, and that's what we're talking about. She set the terms.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century. Forget about digging through stacks of paperwork. This completely online process lets you safely share your bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button. Using a phone or tablet, you can get approved for purchase or refinance in just a few minutes. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, the Olympics may be over, but the Ryan Lochte saga hasn't come to an end just yet. On NBC's Today show, he apologized for over-exaggerating the story of being held at gunpoint in Rio. Then Stephen Colbert had some fun with the interview.
I over-exaggerated that part.
That part. Okay, here's the thing. That part is really the whole part. Without a gun cocked at your forehead, it's really just a story about some guys urinating on a gas station. How could you get that so wrong?
And also jazz harmonica player Toots Thielemans, who composed the iconic theme music for Sesame Street, died on Monday at the age of 94. Join the conversation as the curtain falls in Rio. What moments stand out to you? What do you make of the Ryan Lochte story of the EpiPen pricing controversy? We're joined by Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, Hayes Brown of BuzzFeed News, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Let's talk a moment about the earthquake in Italy, if we might. The dead and injured are in the hundreds from this powerful earthquake in central Italy this week that flattened several small towns, crumbled buildings. Search and rescue operations become more desperate as the hours march on because, of course, there's less of a chance of finding victims alive. Rita is a woman who lives in Amatrice, a city located at the epicenter of the quake. She spoke to Italian television about her experience and is interpreted here by the BBC.
In the middle of the night, there was a terrible shaking and the whole building collapsed. And right afterwards, as I tried to run for it, there were terrible tremors. The town is completely destroyed. There are people injured, people I have known all my life.
You know, I've been thinking the last couple of days that there are many of us who've been to these towns or towns just like this in Italy as tourists, or we've seen them in photos. And I think for that reason, Jack Beatty, the tragedy there has been very eye-opening here in the U.S. this week.
Oh, yes. And the poignance, the scenes of the dogs trying to find, you know, the people being pulled out of the rubble and the clock ticking, the clock of their exposure. And now I'm reading in the Financial Times that the Italian government is going to have a criminal investigation to see whether some of the buildings that fell, they're old buildings, but they had been restored, whether they were up to code in the restoration. For example, the tower that fell on a family, I think in Accumoli, it crushed a family of four people. And that was a restored tower, and the Italian authorities are investigating, was it restored to code?
It's interesting you should mention Jack, because I've heard several people express great concern for the victims and the survivors this week, but also say they'd never thought before about how the lovely charm of these ancient homes and buildings could prove deadly when the ground shakes and that old brick and mortar and concrete move in an earthquake, you know, whether they were rebuilt to code or not. And Hayes, although it's probably not a concern there right now as the search and rescue operations continue, and good luck to everyone involved, you can sort of see how it might cause second thoughts for potential tourists down the road, Hayes.
Yeah, you can, especially since these are some of the most, you know, picturesque towns in central Italy. You think about small villages, you're picturing these towns. And it's so the pictures that are coming out are just really devastating when you see how they've just sort of crumbled in upon themselves. Yeah, the death toll reached, I think the newest number is 267 in this, and the people out there are still suffering from aftershocks. There was a 4.7 aftershock just this morning, as the rescuers were trying to shift through the rubble. So even the people who did survive are not entirely out of harm's way yet. And those that did survive are out of their homes for the most part. They're setting up camps for them to be in for the nights where they're still, you know, going through the search and rescue. In one camp, there were 1,200 people in one camp just trying to make it through the night. And as far as tourism goes, I'm sure they'll rebound. And I can see people flooding back to these areas once rebuilding is complete. The problem is how long it will take to get to that point. Now, the Italian government has declared a state of emergency. They've tossed over millions of euros worth of money for the efforts. But these were really old buildings, and so it's not going to be just like it was once they do finish rebuilding.
And I'm not sure a lot of these towns are certain they will rebound. We have a story on the front page of the Washington Post today about a town that got hit really hard, but already 70% of the homes in that town were empty because they have a huge unemployment problem. Young people are fleeing these towns where they have grown up. And you take this kind of devastation, and it is, you know, in some of these places that they're really worried that they won't rebound.
All right, on to Turkey, if we might. A truck bombing by Kurdish militants kills and wounds dozens today in southeast Turkey, in a province that borders Syria. Part of a rise in deadly attacks there comes directly after Turkey's incursion this week into Syria. Turkish tanks with U.S. air support designed to, they say, clear out ISIS militants from a stronghold supporting supply lines on the Turkish-Syrian border. It feels, Hayes, like a sign this long conflict will go on much longer as Turkey tries to keep Syrian Kurds away from Turkey, fearing they might help Kurdish insurgents in Turkey. And then, of course, the militants respond.
I completely agree. It seemed a couple of years ago like we were so close to having finally some semblance of peace between the Turkish government and the PKK, the militant arm of the Kurdish Workers' Party, and the two of them going back and forth for decades. But it finally seemed like there was going to be a chance that there might be peace between the two, and that has completely collapsed, especially with the war in Syria across the border. You're completely right to say that. I think one of the main reasons why Erdogan launched this incursion into Syria is because he wanted to keep Syrian Kurds from linking up with Turkish Kurds and forming their own sort of military power in the region. And the U.S. is very aware of that and wants to keep the peace as best as possible, because the last thing we need when we're fighting ISIS is for Turkey to become even more consumed with its war against its own Kurds, which has really distracted away from efforts to get them to take a harder military stance against the Islamic State.
All of this highlights Washington's complicated relationship in the region. Turkey's been a reliable ally, but the Syrian Kurds are close allies with the U.S. in Syria. Vice President Joe Biden was in Turkey this week, speaking at a news conference with the prime minister. He addressed last month's attempted coup in Turkey, denying that the U.S. had any advanced knowledge of it. Here he is.
People of the United States of America abhor what happened, and under no circumstances would support anything remotely approaching the cowardly act of the treasonous members of your military who engaged in this behavior.
tough messaging there from Vice President Joe Biden, but it all feels like a very muddled message about U.S.-Turkish relations with the U.S. and in the region, Jack Beatty.
Yes, it does. He went on to say, kind of phrase you might hear from a World War II movie, we told our friends the Kurds to stay on the east bank of the Euphrates. Don't cross that river. The labyrinthine politics here are almost exceed one's ability to describe. And the Turkish paranoia, whether it's ginned up by the regime or by people on the street about the CIA and not even the CIA, this cleric in Pennsylvania, that he somehow manipulated this coup, and now there's issues about whether he'll be extradited, and it seems like that we have seriously, that this has become a serious issue, and so clearly this we were more than happy to help the Turks out with airstrikes here, because it was a way of showing, you know, we're still with you.
Hayes Brown, chances you think that the U.S. will allow the extradition of this cleric here in the U.S. accused by the Turkish government of helping to plot or leading the coup?
Personally, I think that the odds of Gulen actually being extradited to Turkey are pretty low right now. The DOJ has a ton of lawyers combing through everything that Turkey is handing over to see if there is a case to be made. And so far, the answer is no. The Turks just the other day admit that everything they've handed over had nothing to do with the coup. It was all to do with his other alleged crimes. They haven't yet put together a link saying this is actual proof that we have that Gulen helped mastermind this coup. And until they find something like that, he's staying put in Pennsylvania in his compound.
All right, let's move on to talk about EpiPens, which are in the news this week because of the suddenly skyrocketing cost of these pens used to treat instant and severe allergic reactions. Now that it's been disclosed by the maker, the company Mylan, that it's hiked the cost by several hundred percent, Mylan has said it'll offer discounts for some patients but will not actually lower the price. Has Mylan become the newest in the recent string of the most hated drug companies in the U.S., Jack Beatty?
Yes, it has. Its CEO is a very, very capable woman who is nevertheless the daughter of Joe Manchin, the senator from West Virginia. And she's going to have to testify before Congress, and it's going to be her father may even be on the committee questioning her. And, you know, as I was reading about this, it sounded like Mylan suddenly had itself in a monopoly situation, and that the typical thing is when a generic is going to come on the market and you're going to lose your advantage on your patent, you up the price to get as much as you can before the competition comes along. Well, what happened here, at least as I've read, is that the competition was knocked out by the FDA. They didn't get clearance. So therefore, Mylan was able to just keep taking in its monopoly rents and exploiting them, and without the competition. So it was it's a moment in what you might call oligopoly, when only a few firms control the market.
I want to talk to Megan, who's an On Point listener. She's dialing from Somerville, Massachusetts, and she has an experience in her family with EpiPens. Megan, hi. Thanks for calling.
I am paying attention to this issue in the news because my aunt passed away a few years ago after having a sting of bee stings. Her EpiPen was expired, and I'm a physical therapist that advocates for increased access to health. My question is, after reading the New York Times article this morning by Andrew Pollack, Representative Cummings from Baltimore, says Mylan should offer not after the fact discounts only for a select few. It should reverse its massive price increases across the board immediately. And what do the news panel think of that? Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Megan, for calling. Why don't we ask Hayes Browns to give us his take on that?
I can't help but agree. Usually when you see drugs with high prices on the market, in the past, drug companies explained it, oh, it's the cost of research and development, where, you know, we spend so much money to put this on the market, except in this case, the prices started out low and have just continually started to rise as their brand name has saturated the market. You don't think of EpiPen, you don't think of them, you just think of EpiPens. That is what the product in people's minds is. And the fact that they're, you know, mandated in schools now and things like that, they really just need to bring down the price to make them much more accessible again to the average citizen who is now convinced that they need them thanks to the marketing that EpiPens have had.
Jack Beatty, it's not hard to imagine, though, that Mylan will just try to stiffen its back and ride this controversy out. What happens, though, to the company if a little kid or maybe more than one kid dies due to a simple peanut allergy because their parents couldn't afford the new high-priced EpiPen and did not connect with a company discount?
Bob, you should be a troubleshooter for this corporation. That's exactly the contingency they have to prepare for. And they have to sort of shift the hat from gouging, from, you know, we're just doing what the market will bear, to, wait a minute, our whole image, which can affect the future of this company, is at stake. We have to recalibrate and precisely to be able to deal with a contingency such as the one you outlined.
Karen, is there any will in Congress to deal with this, the issue of drug companies or investors newly super profiting over medications that used to be accessible and affordable?
The drug industry is really one of the most powerful lobbies in Washington. I recall during the efforts to pass health care reform in 2009 that, you know, the biologic drugs, the biotech drugs, for instance, got all kinds of patent protection. Henry Waxman got rolled by his own committee. They will talk a lot, but the chances of anything getting done are slim. And it also goes to the craziness of healthcare pricing. A lot of people will say, well, I'm not paying for that. My insurance company is paying for that.
And that will do it for us today on Point. Thanks to our guest, Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post. Thank you very much for joining us, Karen.
It was great to be here.
Hayes Brown of BuzzFeed News, thanks to you.
Thanks for having me.
And On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Always great, Jack. Thanks.
Thank you, Bob.
Continue the conversation and get to the On Point podcast on our website at onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up on Monday, 2016, and the down ballot races. We'll take a look at the key races, the bruising battles, and the big stakes this November. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.